likes that idea. But anyway, so, but then deacons begin to sit like the spiritual advisory board, and they make the spiritual decisions for the church and the pastors. Sure, the pastor gets up and preaches, but everything else he does is work that the deacons should be doing. And that happens accidentally. I think it happens accidentally and inadvertently many times. But if it begins to be noticed, then there's, you know, nah, we like this, you know, human nature kind of tends to like the way things end up being when it's wrong. So, anyway, a couple comments on that distinctive of Baptists. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 is what we're going to be looking at this morning, and we're going to be looking at the first 14 verses. Now, each week we have visitors, and so I'd like to put the text into the context of what we've been looking at through this summer. And the very first words of the book says, "the words of the preacher," or something like that. I'm not looking at particularly. But if we think of that, just let it sink into us. And in one sense, I'm not trying to take away from it, but not say, well, these are special words of Scripture. If we just think on a practical sense, what words do preachers say? A preacher is known, he's known, of course he says a lot more words, but he's known for preaching, for saying sermons. So the book of Ecclesiastes is a sermon from the preacher. It's a different type of sermon, but it is a sermon. And the text that he takes is our experiences in life. The text he takes is in verses 2 through 11 of the first chapter. And just to summarize there, he looks around at life. What we see when we're going around, when we're working, when we're doing things, and when we're living, what we see here, and he sees life under the sun doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Things that should happen don't happen. Things that shouldn't happen do happen. It doesn't make sense. Life doesn't happen the way it's supposed to. And so mankind comes to the conclusion that life is meaningless. If all it is what's here, it's meaningless. It's empty. The word he uses is vain, or full of emptiness, full of vanity, and it's unfulfilling. And that is true. If we just look around at us, and if all we had to live for is what is here, it's not worth living for. It's empty. It's meaningless. And so that's his text, the first 11 verses of the first chapter is the text. And it goes from there and begins to talk about different places that mankind goes to find meaning. Whoever you are, whether you know God or not, you look around and say, well, this doesn't make any sense. I'm going to try to make sense out of what I'm facing. And mankind looks in a lot of different places. Some of them, to our understanding, I would say are better than others, but they're all places that mankind looks for fulfillment, for meaning in their life. And the first one he addresses is knowledge, wisdom. People think that if they pursue knowledge, that will give them something to live for. I mentioned this last week, and you know, knowledge is power, isn't it? We agree. We could say, yeah, there's some power in knowing things. And so some people, they just devote their lives to learning and knowing, and think that if they know enough, they'll finally be fulfilled. And what the preacher tells us, shows us, is that if you're searching for meaning and the only place you're searching for it is in knowledge and in learning, you'll come up empty. You'll learn more and more, and the more you know, the more pain and hurt that you'll know about. It won't fulfill. So knowledge and wisdom by itself is not the answer to to the emptiness that we have within ourselves. And then he goes and begins to talk about pleasurable things, things that are exciting, things that are fun. And there's a wide range of those things, and he doesn't deny that they do give us pleasure. In the middle of some type of fun activity, we would think, wow, things could never be better than the way they are now. And it might not ever be better than the way they are then, but that activity will stop, and once it stops, it's over. And the fun and the enjoyment and the fulfillment that you had in the instant, in the moment, is gone, and you long for it again. You look back on times when, man, wasn't it so fun when we did this? We need to do that again. Why do you need to do it again? Didn't it fulfill? No, it doesn't fulfill. Pleasurable things, whether they're sports activities or leisure activities, even many people, rightly so, get pleasure from work, even from just accomplishing something. You fix the yard up and it looks beautiful. You can enjoy that until the next week when the weeds come there and you got to do it again, right? So whatever type of pleasure it is, that doesn't answer. That doesn't fill the void that is built into mankind. And then mankind, some men, look to business and to business pursuits. And in that sense, they think, if I just give myself to my work, they're a workaholic, and they work and work, and they do accomplish things. And here again, working isn't bad. In fact, we were made to work, weren't we? We were created to work, and so work is good. But if you give yourself to work and business, you find that you're thwarted and frustrated by a multitude of different things. Evil men, by time itself, which God is in control of. So back and forth, if you give yourself to work, if you look to find fulfillment in just business and work, you're not going to find it there. It doesn't fill the void that is within us. And then public pursuits, whether it's in church or in other areas, in government, public pursuits, things that we do publicly. Sometimes people think, well, if I have this, people will remember me and whatever. And those types of things don't fulfill. They don't give meaning to us. And then what we looked at last week was wealth. Okay, so knowledge isn't necessarily bad, but it doesn't fulfill. Pleasure does give, it is pleasurable, but it can especially, it can lead toward things that are bad even. Okay, so knowledge is better than pleasure. And then working in business, living in public are not necessarily evil in and of themselves, but they don't fulfill in and of themselves. Wealth, last week we looked at the idea of some people work and they get a taste of wealth, and then they want it, they live for wealth. They're covetous. Whether you're poor or rich, covetousness is something that we all must face. Every man has, it's built into us to want to be covetous. That's built into us in the fall. It came to us in the fall to be covetous. Sometimes, some people would say even that people that have wealth and riches may be less covetous than others. Some of them might be because they have the money and they know what it can do and they know what it can't do. If you don't have money, you think money's the answer for everything, don't you? That's like, if I only had this, if I had that, then I would be happy. And we know in our own experience, because we've been without and then we've gotten what we didn't have, and we still have this emptiness within us. If we think about that particular situation, there's wealth and having things, covetousness for sure, fulfilling or trying to satisfy covetousness doesn't satisfy. You can never satisfy want. Want always wants. And so wealth is a place where mankind looks for meaning and purpose and fulfillment, but will never find it there either. Now, none of these fulfill. And throughout the book, along the way, different times, we've come to a partial conclusion a few times that rather than seek fulfillment and meaning solely or completely in these areas of our existence, it's better to live with what God has given you, doing what God assigns to you, and to be content with that. It's better just to eat and to drink and to do what you've been assigned to do in the place that you've been assigned to do it. No use thinking, well, life would be better for me if I was only over here. No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't be any different than it is right here. So just live here for God the way that you ought to. And that's a partial conclusion that we've come to over and over again. And in one sense, it seems like today's section, the preacher kind of says, this is what we've While my partial conclusion is true, if we just seek for contentment, if we seek only contentment, that won't satisfy either. There is, and by that, I'm going to use a term. It's a term of philosophy, but you might have heard it one way or another, and that is the golden mean. The golden mean, M-E-A-N, and that is not a that is not describing the way someone acts. That is a position to be in. If we were thinking numerically, there's a mean is like the average. It's in the middle. And the idea of the golden mean is that there's a way to live. If we live within the golden mean, we just kind of live in the middle. This idea has been around for a long time. I'm sure it was around in the time that the preacher was preaching, because he addresses the idea, I believe. But I just want to introduce the idea. I can't remember what grade I was in, and I don't know if we still read the story, but I remember reading a story in grade school. When I saw it again, my understanding is that it's from mythology, but we can learn some things from mythology, kind of like Aesop's fable. This was a fable with a truth in it. And if I'm remembering it correctly, there was a dad and his son that had been captured and imprisoned on an island. He was imprisoned on an island, and they longed to be free from there, and they devised the means to escape. And over time, I don't know how they had these things available to themselves, but over time, they were able to gather feathers and wax from their candle. And so they took wax and feathers and created wings that they attached. They figured out how to attach them to themselves, and they were going to fly off of this island. Now, you know, don't try this at home. But as the story goes, they, you know, I'm sure they're sitting there in captivity. They see birds flying. I wish I could be as free as a bird. The birds just come and go and do whatever they want. If we could fly, we could get away from here. So they gathered feathers and they put them together using hardened wax. And the father told the son, they knew it would work, they tested it or something, and when it was time to go, he told his son, we have to be careful, you can't fly too low, because the moisture from the sea will cause the feathers to lose their whatever it is, they'll wilt and you'll fall into the sea. Don't fly too high, because the warmth of the sun will melt the wax, and the feathers will fall apart and you'll plunge to your death. And you know, so what was the instruction? Well, so the son, what does he do? He soars and soars and soars, and he loves the feeling of flying, and he gets so high, and pretty soon the wax melts and he plunges to his death. His wings disintegrate. The moral of the story is what? Stay in the middle. Don't go too high, don't go too low. So this is a theme that's been throughout mankind's existence forever. Stay in the middle. I remember reading not that long ago, and there's some truth to this. There's a ditch on both sides of the road. You're driving down the road, you want to stay out of the ditch. Well, I'm just going to be completely over here. Well, that won't work, because there's a ditch on both sides of the road. There's all kinds of sayings that and things that we can think of and recognize that this idea of living in the golden mean has been with us for a long time, and in one sense, it has tremendous merit to it. Just like seeking after knowledge and wisdom is good, seeking to live in one sense in the middle, in the golden mean, is good, and this is going to take us 2 weeks. I'm warning you already, Sam. But the golden mean, just living in the middle, isn't the answer. It is a practice that we should follow and watch and utilize, but it's not just the answer. Both Western and Eastern traditions, philosophy and religion, have adherence to this theme. Confucius, I've never read Confucius, but I just looked up the golden mean, and he's got a book. Way, way back, whenever Confucius wrote. I'm a student of Western civilization, so I don't know when Confucius wrote. These are both Western civilization teachers, too, so it was way back. So Eastern tradition, Buddha also. I say Western civilization. Of course, the Hebrews would be considered Eastern in a certain sense. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Aristotle is known, I teach every fall when I talk about philosophy of education and history of education. Aristotle is known. If you see golden mean on the test, you match that phrase with Aristotle. And just an example that they would use often is the issue of bravery. Think about bravery. What makes someone brave? It's someplace between running from danger as a coward and running into every danger. Just because you run into danger doesn't mean you're brave. You might be rash. You may be an idiot. Okay, but bravery. That's just an example. Bravery is somewhere in the middle, somewhere some mean between rashness and cowardice. These ancient philosophies, these philosophers, this idea would teach that true meaning for life, true fulfillment of life comes from just living in the middle. And in a certain sense, we might think that that's what the preacher has been saying along here, right? He's been saying, you know, don't seek after a lot of this and don't, you know, pleasures aren't going to fulfill, and you give your life to your business and that's not going to fulfill, and if you give your life seeking after money, that's not going to fulfill. Just do what you ought to where you are, and you might think, well, maybe he's just saying live according to the golden mean. Some people believe that. People that don't know God would believe that. And I will say there is some merit, as I said before, to this idea. But we're going to see that it fails as a way of living all by itself. We're going to see that next week. There are many strong points to this idea of living in the golden mean, and we can follow this idea to a point. It can be helpful to us. I would encourage you not to be rash and not to be a coward. Let's just take this as an example. We believe that God calls us to a life of separation. Okay? That means we're going to stay away from this. Okay? But there are people that believe that if they go over here, that makes them holy. And if they go over here, they're even holier, right? And they get over here and they're the holiest of all, or they're at least holier than thou, right? They are holier than thou. And they're all the way over in the ditch on the other side of the road, because holiness doesn't come from a standard necessarily, but holy people will live according to standards. Okay, so that's where I'm saying, to a point, we can take this idea that everything in moderation, right? And if we take that to its logical conclusion, we get into a problem, which we'll see next week. Now, as we go, I would just like to take the first 14 verses here and show you, in one sense, that the preacher has given us a picture of this man of moderation. And then next week we're going to see how living this way, the traps that a person that just says everything in moderation, just keep it in the middle of the road. If you live that way, there's traps that you're going to fall into, and we'll see those next week. This week, that's as far as I'm going to go with this idea. We're going to look at the benefits of it. It is a good thing to think about, and it does, and it can help us live the right way. It's just not the only thing to live in as living the right way. So, Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 14 is a picture of a man of moderation, someone in the golden mean. In verse 1, he says, "A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of one's birth." So, this person recognizes the value of reputation. A good name is better than precious ointment. And a precious ointment, you can imagine you might have different reactions to this, but you've been in a place and somebody walked in the room and they had precious ointment on. We would call it perfume or cologne or something like that. It caught your attention. And if it was precious ointment and you agreed that it was precious ointment, it would catch your attention. You think, wow, that's nice. It adds something, and it's something nice to be around. Now, some of you don't like the smells that people bring into the room, whether they think they're precious or not. But the illustration is someone comes, the good things that come from someone wearing precious ointment, a good name is way better than that, and has a similar type of effect. It gets a good name, gets attention more than a beautiful fragrance. And to have that good name when you die is way better to be born with a good name. Okay? The day of death than the day of one's birth. We could read the newspaper. We may be able to think of people who were born with a good name and sullied it and ruined it and disgraced it through their life. But someone who dies and they've lived a life and their name is still upstanding, it's still a good name, that's much better. So we have a man who seeks to have a good name at the end of his life. So what should he do? He keep a proper perspective of life. Look, it is better, verse 2, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. So keep a proper perspective of life and death. We, in the Psalms, there's in Psalm 90:12, a verse that has kind of helped us through our history here. So teach us to number our days, that we might apply our hearts unto wisdom. That's what this verse is saying. In other words, it's better to go to the house of mourning. It's better to recognize that this life will end than to go to the house of feasting. The end, the living will lay it to heart. So keep a proper perspective of life and death. Verse 3 teaches us to learn from sorrow. There's not much to learn from laughter. Sorrow is better than laughter. For by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. Okay, sorrow comes into our lives, and our heart is made better. We can learn from sorrow. Laughter doesn't teach very many things. Verse 4 seems to summarize those two verses. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. So if you're a fool, if you just think, I can laugh my life away, you will learn if you go to the house of mourning where there is sorrow. Verse 5 says, listen to wise rebuke even if it angers. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. How many of you like to be rebuked? I don't think anybody does. We don't like to be rebuked. We don't like to be told that we're wrong. But we're better off if we listen to that rebuke normally. Sometimes fools will rail on you, and that I wouldn't call that rebuke. But he says here, if you're hearing rebuke from a wise man, you're better off if you endure it, if you listen to it, if you learn from it. Many times we're rebuked, we bristle up, we don't like it, and then we just forget it. Well, that's not helpful. If we're rebuked from a wise person, sure, we're going to bristle up and we're not going to like it, but we ought to listen to it and learn from it. It's better for us than to just have fools sing songs to us. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. It's vanity. You take some brush, you put it under a pot, you light it on fire, and pretty soon it's gone. There's nothing to it. And that's what fools compliment you, fools, whatever, they help you laugh about things, and it's empty. It's worthless. So fool's praise is empty. Surely oppression makes a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. And I must admit, I couldn't figure out how that fit into the whole thing. I know it does, but the preacher's wiser than I am, and I couldn't figure that one out. So I'm going to move along as I'm running out of time anyway. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So, be patient. Be patient. Patience is better than arrogance. We've all seen the guy who's at the beginning of it saying, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and I'm great. That's proud. He's prideful. He's arrogant. It's the beginning. The end is way better than the beginning. We could learn that in our kindergarten program, right? You know, the tortoise and the hare. So, be patient. Patience is better than arrogance. The end is better than the beginning. Say not thou, verse 10, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. He says, don't get it into your mind that the old days are good. In the old days, in the good old days, the former days, don't say, why were the former days better than these? You don't inquire wisely concerning that. I know we want to look back and say, well, yeah, but back then it was good. It was better than it is now. That's not what we're supposed to do. Okay. I'm not saying we can't learn from the past, but here, don't think the old days are better than the new. That's, we don't inquire wisely when we live with that thinking that everything back before was better. So then he says, seek wisdom more than money. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there's profit to them that see the sun, those that are living under the sun. And for wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense, but the excellence of knowledge or wisdom is that wisdom gives life to them that have it. So the question is, what he says here is, seek wisdom more than money. What does an inheritance without wisdom bring? Right? See the question there? Wisdom is good with an inheritance. What good is an inheritance without wisdom, though? Okay, so we got wealth, money, and wisdom. Which one? Seek wisdom more than money. Because wisdom gives life. It's not saying that money, that inheritance is bad, but an inheritance doesn't do you any good if you don't have any wisdom to come with it. And then, don't try to change what God has done. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? A lot of times we look at the way things are and we say, that's not the way it is, and I'm gonna change this. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do what's right and we shouldn't stand for what's right. But some things we're not going to change. God has made it a certain way. If he's made it crooked, we're not going to make it straight. If he's made it straight, we're not going to make it crooked. Don't try to change what God has done. God does things. He does these things to teach us. Now, if you're a crook, change. Okay, but so don't. So, and that's where that's next week's lesson. Everything in moderation. Some people say, "Well, a little evil isn't that bad." Okay. Well, yes, it is. Okay, and that's the problem that somebody who devotes themselves just to living in the middle, doesn't keep everything else in perspective that goes along with it, will fall into some snares that are incorrect and not the way to live. But as a help to us, yes, we should remember these things and not fall in the ditch on the right side of the road or the one on the left side of the road or whatever. So, but as a way of life, we're going to see next week that this just staying in the middle, it doesn't fulfill, doesn't answer the questions, doesn't answer the needs that we have as creatures that God has made. Let's pray. Our Father,